Good evening. This is Mae Bressel. The title of this program is World Watchers. It is program number 824, September the 21st, 1987. For the last 3 weeks, I've been talking about items in the news that identify the Reagan administration to gun running, to terrorists, to George Habash, the Achille Lauro hijacking, to Abu Habas, to Abu Nidal. And it's very important to not lose sight of those names. They're a little bit complicated, but I want you to remember them and remember the linkage that is coming out now regarding arms to Iran and the administration and the role of Ollie North and Admiral Poindexter connected to these particular people and Henry Kissinger, former National Security Advisor with his links to Mr. Agnelli of Fiat. And I just want to run those down for you real quickly before I get on to some other news. August the 31st, program number 881, I was making the links, making the connections that I take from the regular news media. This one was from Newsday. The links of Manzar Al-Qassar, the most well-known drug dealer and arms dealer in Syria, after Henry Arsan passed away, evidently taking over his throne because they connect directly. And their links to George Habash as well is to General Secord, Albert Hakim, and Oliver North. The following week, September the 7th, program 882, I was making more connections of the Italian arms to Iran, the relationship to Abu Habas, the mastermind between the Achille Lauro, the yellow fruit account of our Defense Department that Oliver North could use, the role of Ladin connected to that, the mystery of Demavan, Henry Arsan, the Vatican, Ronald Reagan, and it's very important to put Ronald Reagan right into this, and Mr. Glauco Partel, Nguyen Bank, Eugene Bartholomaeus, because this whole story is like the tar baby. Reagan's getting his little fingers into the tar, and it may be time for the powers that be to ease him out, and I'll go into that in a few seconds or minutes. The following week, after the broadcast on the arms and mystery of Demavan, etc., I brought up on program 823 last week the Wall Street Journal article, Italy Arrests 32 in Investigation of Arms Sales, involving a family, Mr. Ferdinand Barletto and his son. Weapons sold to Iran, 3 million mines sold to Iran that made were in Italy, and done by people involved with our Defense Department, links to our military, and also 50% of the company is owned by Fiat, which is headed by Giovanni Agnelli. He's chairman of Kissinger Associates, a member of the notorious P2, and this article, this series of articles just the past week, make the connection to Abu Nidal. So for several weeks, George Habash, Achille Lauro, Abu Habas, and Abu Nidal are getting closer to the Reagan administration, and the Washington Post had an article September the 9th. In addition to all of these factors, they had a plot to kill Ronald Reagan at the Venice summit. And for reasons of, I guess, good security or being working on this case for a few months, which the articles say they did, the helicopter was not blown up there, but Oliver North was part of the Federal Emergency Management. And you remember when Reagan was shot, and or maybe you don't, in 1981, how George Bush and Alexander Haig in particular and the Defense Department were ready to step right in. Well, there was an article in the Washington Post one day earlier than the one describing these same terrorists and the plot to kill Reagan. It leaves that out, but I want to share that with you right now. It's titled, Italy May Find Its Own Mines in the Persian Gulf. 33 arrested in illegal arms shipments to Tehran in a scandal Rome calls the Iran Gate. And this is very similar to the one that they had the next day, except it leaves out the Reagan, the idea that these people are also sending rockets and weapons to shoot down Ronald Reagan. And just some of the points in this article that are not in the others I mentioned last week. It says, the story as it unfolded in the Italian press involves a rich, well-known industrialist, scion of one of Italy's leading capitalist clans, a secret middleman of dual nationality, illegal arms to Iran via third countries, a raid by the customs agents of a Lebanese freighter carrying arms for terrorists linked to Abu Nidal, and drugs for the mafia, and secret documents left behind hastily in a vacated hotel room. And that's how the P2 scandal broke, when over 500 names were located in hotel room. Over the past month, August Alama, one of the prosecutors, investigating magistrate, is working in the Tucson port city of Mesa, and the public prosecutor Giovanna Panabianco on Saturday issued 45 warrants for arrest. And I mentioned the prominent arms manufacturer Ferdinand Borlotto and his son Giovanni. The senior Borletti, grandson of the founder of Italy's popular Rinascente department store chain, holds a company, heads it, a company that makes mines, especially mines and munition, called Valsella Meccanotassina in Italy. Half the company is owned by another firm, Gilardini, a subsidiary of Fiat conglomerate, and the Fiat conglomerate is Mr. Agnelli, and on the board of that, sharing with Kissinger Associates, of course, are Agnelli and Kissinger are very, very close. And this is important because for years I've maintained that Kissinger was part of the supersedes me that creates the left, so the left, the Red Brigades, or whether in Reagan's case, the SLA, and the creating the terrorism, the Bologna bombing, and et cetera, the different kinds of strategy of tension with former Nazis, the heirs of Otto Skorzeny, and working with him until he was alive until 1975, could create a military dictatorship out of terrorism. This Washington Post story on the 8th said the Borlettis and others are accused of not only shipping illegal arms to Iran, but associating with suspected mafia figures and unspecified Arab terrorists believed to be linked with Abu Nidal Group. And the article goes on, Italian authorities arrested Boutros, the head of a 16-man crew, and a mystery Arab passenger with a false passport. The ship was searched coming into Italy from Lebanon with arms and drugs. The people said that Aldo Anghesa, and I mentioned him last week, a reputed middleman in the clandestine arms commerce between Italy and Middle East, holds both Italian and Swiss citizenships, naturally, and he was waiting for the ship, the Bari, to be docked. They raided Anghesa's hotel room, and that's when they found these documents, and then he turned himself in. According to investigators, the prosecutors claimed to have evidence that the arms were being brought to Italy by the ship's crew for Arab terrorists in Italy, who are possibly linked to the Abu Nidal case. And again, years ago in 1982, I was doing broadcasts on Abu Nidal as having been behind the shooting of an Israeli ambassador in London that gave the feeble excuse for Alexander Haig in June of 82 to tell the Israelis to invade Lebanon. And at that time, they picked up several $1 million worth of weapons that they sold as arms around the world for their own profits. Now, there were several other articles, not as long as the Washington Post story, but in other papers. One is titled, Italians May Have Their Iran Scam Too, Arms Ring Allegedly Plotted to Kill Reagan. Another one from the Monterey Herald, Italian Mine Sent to Iran, Probe Bersay, the illegal arms ring believed broken. Well, it isn't broken. These things aren't broken. They're just fractured. And then Newsweek had a story, The Shame of the Game, The Smell from the Scandal Blows Over Europe. And I'm citing these sources because so far I didn't see anything in Time magazine, but the Reagan administration, it goes on, called it Operation Staunch. A better name might have been Operation Sieve, as the Iran-Iraq War in the Persian Gulf ground on. American allies kept secretly shipping weapons to Iran regardless of the formal protests, sometimes filed several a month, filed in Washington, and by last fall, the world learned of the White House's own secret arms sale to Iran out of our own country. A U.S. embargo made it look like an outright farce, but the administration's public humiliation was more persuasive than moral argument. The smell of the scandal has now broken over Europe, said House Armed Services Committee Les Aspin, and pressured governments there into halting arms sales. And this is an article out of Newsweek, as I say, September 21st, 1987, The Smell of the Scandal. Another one from the Washington Times, of course, in the past tense, Italy Crushes Ring of Arms and Terror. Now, last week, I said I would go into approximately 10 or 20, 30 translations of Italian papers linking this group to Francesco Pazienza, Michael Ledeen, and Adnan Khashoggi, the son of the Shah of Iran. But there's so many of those and so much other very pertinent news that I'm going to take that part of it and continue next week on that subject, because it would take almost an hour by itself, or I'll break it into segments But there's a couple of other things I want to catch right now. The hearings are going on for Robert Bork. Many of you have been watching them, I hope, the past week. Just this morning, CNN started, and William Coleman from the Warren Commission was a black witness, a former Secretary of Transportation, who objects to the appointment of Robert Bork. And then Barbara Jordan, former congressman, a teacher, a brilliant woman, was on television, and she was so brilliant that the very conservative Republicans didn't want to ask her any questions, and Senator Humphrey agreed that she stumped him and was smarter than him, so they just declined to ask questions because they didn't want her brilliant answers. But as I was watching it, CNN covers our news, and Pacifica Radio has the full coverage. Thank goodness that they do that. I mean, we can all be grateful that they cover that gavel to gavel. It's to their very credit that they do it. The minute that Mr. Coleman was on, and then Barbara Jordan followed, CNN broke the news for Ronald Reagan talking before the United Nations. Now, all during these hearings, there's been selectively Edwin Meese press conferences. During the Iran-Contra, when General Secord was testifying, we had an hour and a half of Jerry Falwell. There were six people in the press room, and then the PTL and Donna Rice and the Gulf, and a very much needed explanation of some of these witnesses was avoided by filling the news puff. But when Reagan was through with the United Nations, CNN didn't go back to the coverage with the two black people who are very capable of expressing their views on why Bork shouldn't be justice of the Supreme Court. And I really think it's an outright racism. I called CNN. Incidentally, their news department is 404-827-1800. And I talked to a Mr. Krieg, and I said this president's conference or speech at the UN could be in the evening news, and we've heard him enough, and these people were deleted from the view of the American people so they could hear them. And then when the Reagan was through, you didn't go back to the hearings. You went to Sonya Live taking questions in Hollywood and how to make guacamole with Mr. Wolf and all the blah blahs and the ridiculous report on AIDS. You used time fillers to fill up that time so you wouldn't give the opportunity to the American people to hear it. So if you want to write to CNN or call them, you might do it. Now, it was interesting to hear William Coleman speaking before the Senate Judiciary on why a vote for Bork would set his rights backwards. William Coleman was on the Warren Commission. He covered up the Nazi-fascist connections to the murder of John Kennedy as he sat there, 1963 and 1964. Now he's getting a galloping view of fascism, recommending Bork for a circuit court but not for the Supreme Court. And all of a sudden, he's getting his smarts. William Coleman realizes what it would do to his race. He didn't think about that before. He didn't think about the fascists he was always covering up. He was very closely associated with David Rockefeller and Nelson Rockefeller. But it was interesting to hear him now with his back against the wall. And if Bork gets in further, his back will be further against the wall. These people seem to think they're immune from fascism. They can play the game, and someday it catches up with them, just like it did in Nazi Germany. Now, another man who's on the Senate Judiciary who hasn't quite made up his mind how to vote is Arlen Specter. And Coleman asked Specter a question. They intimated, of course, both being with the Warren Commission. They're old buddies. Specter invented that bull at 399. And now he's not sure about Bork. And Specter happens to be Jewish. And there's a black, and there's a Jew, and there is Bork, who can define the Constitution any way he wants and take away the rights of minorities if the Constitution didn't say it was there. And now they're waking up to the fact that maybe they have a problem in this country, but if they had done their work with the Warren Commission, they wouldn't have to sit and listen to nominations of Bork or Ronald Reagan or earlier with Richard Nixon, because they were all linked to the fascists. And then there was Ted Kennedy. He's on that Judiciary Committee, praising William Coleman. If you taped it off the television or off the radio, listen to him praising him. What a wonderful man he is. He said, "You made this a better country." I couldn't write down everything he said because I literally was puking in the air. Not really, but just wondering, where are the minds of these people? Here he sat on a commission with the cover-up of the murder of his own brother. William Coleman was on the Warren Commission covering up, lying about Lee Harvey Oswald And now it's 24 years later, and Ted Kennedy is telling him he made this a better country. He made it a better country by allowing John Kennedy to be murdered in that cupboard, and Robert Kennedy, and Chappaquiddick even with Ted Kennedy. His performance was to look the other way and not go into the specifics of how these things happened, the murder of Mary Jo Kopechne and so forth, or you know, just being there to decide that we can cover this up. And it was really disgusting to see how these people grovel and play with each other, have no sense of history at all, and no loyalty to the people who are gunned down. Now, Jack Anderson had an article, Bork versus the Freedom of Information Act. He cites examples in Maripol versus Meese. The children of executed Soviet spies, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, had used the Freedom of Information to seek FBI documents on their parents' case. The FBI withheld documents that they said were entitled to exemption by reason of national security and privacy and law enforcement needs. Bork's opinion on perhaps the most extensive Freedom of Information request ever made said the FBI's withholding the documents was proper. In McGee, that's Ralph McGee versus CIA, the court ruled that the agency, the CIA, had the burden of proving it had made a thorough search of records in a Freedom of Information Act. Bork dissented, saying there was no evidence of bad faith by the CIA, but merely bureaucratic inefficiency, and that's Bork on that case. Now, the undecided on the judiciary panel, in case you want to write these down and write to these people and tell them how you feel, is Robert Byrd, Dennis DeConcini, and Howell Heflin, and Arlen Specter. Byrd from Virginia, DeConcini from Arizona, Heflin from Alabama, he was on the Iran-Contra hearings, and Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania. He's not sure that he wants to have Robert Bork. And the ones for it, of course, are Strom Thurmond, Orrin Hatch, Alan Simpson, Charles Grassley, and Gordon Humphrey. So if you want to write letters, don't write to the people who already are against him, such as Patrick Leahy, Paul Simon, Howard Metzenbaum, Edward Kennedy, and Biden. Write to Byrd and DeConcini, Heflin, and Specter, and tell them how you feel. Now, judges are very important, and Ronald Reagan has made over 231 appointments so far that will affect people's lives in the Court of Appeals of what they can do. The San Jose Mercury had a story September the 19th about the way Ronald Reagan is using the courts in addition to trying to put this nominee on the court. It's titled, Sources Link the Judge's Retirement to the Medal. President Reagan will award the Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian award, to former Chief Justice Warren Burger, the one who helped write a new constitution with no trial by jury, and Judge Irving Kaufman, the White House said Friday. The Washington Post said that Attorney General Meese and several White House people arranged for Judge Kaufman to get the medal after he agreed to retire from active service. Kaufman's retirement and the medal were part of an explicit trade. Now, Judge Kaufman, it continues, the retirement of Kaufman, a liberal on many issues, makes room for a conservative, for a Reagan conservative, on the closely divided Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in New York. The Reagan administration plans to nominate Stuart Summitt, a former law partner of Deputy Attorney General Arnold Burns, to fill the vacancy. Summitt would be the administration's eighth appointment out of 13-member panel, considered one of the most important in federal courts. The Washington Post said that two senior White House officials opposed awarding Kaufman the medal, but others joined Meese to persuade Reagan to give him the medal. It is my understanding there was no quid pro quo between the medal and Kaufman, said Terry Eastland, a Justice Department spokesman. Kaufman announced in June he was taking senior status on the appeals court. He announced it and he refused to comment on the trade. Kaufman, as a trial court judge, ordered the execution of Soviet spies Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, along with Roy Cohn, who was one of assistants, who was on the board of Western Gold and just died of AIDS this past year. And he was also on the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. He assisted Judge Kaufman in the execution of the Rosenbergs in 1951. He's also known for his liberal rulings of the First Amendment, civil rights, prisoners' rights, environmental protection, and other issues. Now, one of the things that Judge Kaufman did that isn't here, as soon as Reagan became president, he asked Judge Kaufman to be head of the chairman of a crime commission to investigate organized crime in this country. And after the crime commission was finished, you didn't hear very much about it because the conclusions that were printed in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and Washington Post, and then hushed up, were the Italian pizza money. And that goes back to those terrorists and drug dealers in Syria and Stiebaum, and also Nazi connections of Mengele and Klaus Barbie in South America. He concluded, and his commission concluded, that a lot of that money that came from this large group of drug dealers, drugs and arms and mafia, and you see the term mafia in terms related to the Agnelli company, the Fiat, that owns 50% of the mine manufacturer. The Crime Commission referred to and did extensive work on the deposits of the organized crime money, and not just organized crime. It was the Italian Stiebaum that I've talked about for years, and since 1982 when the report came out, that it was linked to E.F. Hutton, and chairman of the E.F. Hutton was, until just a few months ago, Scott Pierce, the brother-in-law of George Bush. And the other firm that was noticeable for depositing this money, Italian pizza mafia money, gun running, was Merrill Lynch. And chairman of Merrill Lynch was Donald Reagan, who then became Secretary of the Treasury and then later White House Chief of Staff. And he kept that appointment even after this report came out about his institution depositing this money. And it involved a lot of money. It was called the Pizza Connections. And it went right to Tommaso Busetta and the Italian Stiebaum and the P2 connections to drugs and guns and so forth. When Martha Mitchell was aware of the arrest at Watergate, the first thing she said was, "The mafia is in the White House." That's when she was taken to the hospital and got an injection in her butt and a few in her hotel room, and then proceeded to slowly disintegrate of a horrible cancer, as I've said before, with symptoms not different, very different from AIDS. So Judge Kaufman will step down because he's too liberal on other issues, but he's also being pushed out because it was his crime report of E.F. Hutton and Merrill Lynch that could be the key to the Iran-Contra story if it were properly developed and if it's the biggest eye in the world. Now, last week, we had a fundraising at Kazoo. It's a listener-sponsored station. So after my first hour of news, I have a talk show and I take calls. And then I stayed in the station to help with telephone calls afterwards for a couple hours. And for the first time since I've been on the air, and this is 16 and a half years, there were approximately six or seven telephone calls, one after the other, furious that I talked about the Pope, that I talked about his relationship that was in the Chronicle past week, about links to the P2, to the late Michele Sindona, God's Banker, the late Roberta Calvi, part of the God's Banker, and Paul Marcinkus. And I don't know whether it was one woman and one man, and each called three times, but they were furious. Where are your sources about working for IG Farben and so forth? Many of you have heard this over and over, but nobody has called the station. Just, we knew they weren't regular listeners, but with the Pope coming here 2 days later, 3 days later, they were really up in the air and tuned and told to listen to the program. I'm sure they never heard it before and don't care about it. But when I gave the sources and I gave my telephone number, I said, call the house and I'll talk to you during the week. I'll give you the sources of Solvay Chemical, IG Farben. Not one of them called. And so for those that are listening that wouldn't call in tonight, the San Francisco Chronicle, September the 16th, had a story about the Pope, and it said Wojtyla participated in underground efforts to help the Jews escape the Nazi Holocaust. And there never was one piece of that in his biography, autobiography, that he did that. And the same Chronicle says that Wojtyla pursued his studies in acting while supporting himself at jobs in a stone quarry, later in a chemical plant. Now, we heard about the stone quarry and the chemical plant, and they were both Solvay Chemical, IG Farben. And I did find another article in the newspaper, a different paper, that did identify in the San Francisco Examiner, the background of the Pope, and it tells about that Poland was occupied under the Nazis. Wojtyla's father had a heart attack. He started studying for priesthood at night in the underground in Krakow, working at in the day as a laborer for Solvay Chemical Plant. Solvay is IG Farben. My regular listeners know there's many sources to this. Also, when John Paul II was in Monterey, he urged the landowners and the growers, he had a large mass for 70,000 or 80,000 people here, to respect the just claims, and this is a quote, to respect the just claims of migrant workers. In remarks prepared for delivery in San Francisco, he also told the people who had AIDS that God loved them. But in his speech here, it was for the large Catholic population, and he told them that the growers and the landowners should respect the claims of the migrant workers. Well, the very day he was here, there was a claim put outside the Carmel Mission by an American Indian who claimed that the mission belongs to them and that they're ready to take it back. And the Monterey Herald has a story, having been forbidden by the Diocese of Monterey to enter the graveyard and pray for their ancestors buried there, about 15 Indians marched solemnly to the rectory door, rang the electric bell, and asked to see Monsignor McMahon, pastor of the Carmel Mission Basilica. When McMahon came to the door, Indian leader Anthony Miranda asked permission to enter the graveyard. "I don't have the authority," said McMahon. "I have again to say no. The diocese established authority. You can pray anywhere. The mission is closed to everyone. You can come back on Friday." And he told them that they couldn't come into the mission. He said, "We are sad, the fact that the church refuses to let us in, but, however, the land is ours, and Grandfather is buried there. We want to see him." And at that point, they handed to the person in charge of the mission, Monsignor Eamon McMahon, a notice that they're ready to take back the mission, that it was their property, that it wasn't sold, it wasn't bartered off or traded for anything. It was literally stolen from this particular tribe of Indians who were there at the time, and that they were prepared to take it back because there's no way that it belonged to the Vatican. And he said, "We, the Costa Noan people, claim this land back from for my people." And they posted a notice, as I say, "This is our land." So the Pope says that the farmers should give land to the migrants who come here. So maybe it's time for the Vatican to give back the land it stole from the Indians in the first place. And the whole tone of the Vatican isn't just one small issue. The Latin America Press, that is sent to me by a listener, has many articles about the Vatican continuously. One last week, September the 3rd, bishops line up with the ultra-right as Argentines go to the polls. And I mentioned that Pio Luigi was here on the Monterey Peninsula, and he gave comfort to the Argentine right, the tortures, and so forth, and was here the day that the Pope was here. Another article from Latin America Press, just there are many, many, but these are just pertinent this week. Brazil's progressive Catholic bishops retreat on some key political issues, and the Catholic is pressuring them to go back on their views, and the Catholics are very active in turning the clock back. And it's just very sad that some people just don't grow, or institutions don't grow and seem to stay the same no matter what the minds or the wills of the people, the awareness is. The growing awareness of people is one thing, and those who control them is another, and that's the way it seems to go throughout history. Now, regarding the Vanunu trial, there's four articles on Cameroon. I'm not going through all of them for you. I just want to cite them. The National Geographic, it was sent to me by a World Watcher just this past month in September, 87, has an article, "Silent Death from Cameroon, the Killer Lake." And it said, "Without warning, one evening in 1986, a lethal jet of carbon dioxide spewed from Lake Neos. Local myths tell of angry outbursts of lake spirits. The gas has posed many questions for scientists." And if you read the National Geographic article, and I'll share more of it with you later, it continues about what happened in Cameroon. It said experts disagreed on why the gas released so violently. They had a conference last March that I cited for some of you. They compared data and theory. There's several schools of thoughts that emerged. There's not one single one. Some think carbon dioxide gas accumulated. The majority of the scientists concluded the gas had dissolved slowly in the lake. itself, and that it was simply a time bomb. Then the question was asked, what event finally triggered the release? The scientists were unable to agree on the mechanism, but many possible triggers were identified, and of course they list a few of those, but nothing about the possibility of a neutron bomb. And there's some very good pictures of Cameroon if you want to see it in National Geographic. Now, the Kansas City Times had a letter to the editor this September sent to me by World Watch. It's called Denied Support. 2 years ago, Mordechai Vanunu, a technician at Israel's Dimona nuclear complex, revealed to the London Times that Israel possesses not only hundreds of nuclear warheads, but also the hydrogen bomb and the neutron bomb. I'll take a 1 minute now for a break, but in some articles it's very clear that Israel has the neutron bomb, and I want to share that with you and just go back to several more articles about Cameroon and continue along with some of the news.